Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist. I'm Claire. So if we haven't met yet, I'm a registered nutritionist. I have a background in exercise science and natural fertility education as well. And I focus solely on PCOS because I have it too. So I know how frustrating the symptoms can be, but I also know that they can get better, right? When you get to what I call the root cause. It's not that you caused your PCOS, it's just that there's likely a system in your body that isn't functioning optimally. Say your insulin, which controls your blood glucose, is one of the main ones, your stress hormones, your thyroid, your inflammation. And when we can actually get work to optimize those, that can help to bring down our hormones that are giving us all the symptoms like the hair growth and the hair loss and the weight gain and fertility issues. So that's what I focus on helping you understand. But today we've got a slightly different topic. So we've got Dr. Emily Ventura, who is the co-author of a book called Sugar Proof. So Sugar Proof is really actually around sugar in children and how this can affect their behavior and their health long term, and really how to set children up with good eating patterns for life. Now, when Emily contacted me, I was like really interested in the topic, but I got on the phone with her immediately and I was like, look, I want to make sure that in this book, because I hadn't read it at that stage, I was like, I just want to make sure that you're not demonizing sugar, because I know that this can be such a big thing. And is the reason I was quite interested in getting her on is because so many of you ask me, they say, right, I've now found out that I have a genetic predisposition to develop insulin resistance, and that I think that my children are going to be the same. And so how do I actually set them up, but without going through the same sort of disordered eating patterns that I might have gone through in my childhood? And this is a really important thing, that given, you know, I know that many of you will have had or developed disordered eating, and especially around food being labeled good and bad, and maybe weight issues as a child, and having people comment on what you're eating or your body, and that we really don't want to do that. So I said to her, look, you know, I'm really interested, because I want you to be able to get that, because I'm not the expert in how to talk to your children about this, because I'm not a parent, but also I'm not a pediatric nutritionist. So I'm not understanding the nuances of language that we would use with children, or how we would go about this process. So that's why I thought this would be such a great resource for any of you who are either parents or soon to be parents, or even just, it's actually really interesting reading the book as well. I got a lot of actually really good tips for myself and the way that I would work with people as well, in how to talk about foods. And it's not really ever talking about them or labeling, but instead, you know, using techniques like motivational interviewing to ask the children about what they think would be a good option, or what they would like to try, or what, you know, how about we go and try this recipe, and getting them really involved in the cooking and helping set them up for good eating patterns by getting them interested in food from a young age, and also having tried a lot of different variety of foods from a young age as well. So Emily's background is that she is a researcher. She has a PhD in health behavior research and also a master's in public health. She's also a mum to two boys who I think are five and eight and a half from memory. And so she has a lot of experience working with children in kind of a clinical experience, but also, you know, in real life as well, and knowing that this is not someone kind of trying to preach to you how to parent your children who has no experience, i.e. me. This is her explaining to you from real life experience about how to actually navigate these quite tricky times, and how to get them interested in a way that's not some like Pollyanna type, oh my God, just, you know, get your children in the kitchen. It's like actually, you know, real examples of, well, what do you do with them in the kitchen? How do you get them interested in when their like attention span is as short as a goldfish? So she's, I think the book is really practical in that way, which I really like. But also she got into this field working as an intern at Alice Walters Edible Schoolyard Project in Berkeley, and just seeing how that changed, how they could, you know, incorporate learning around maths and fractions in the kitchen, or history and the history of food. So really, really interesting background. And I think they've brought this book and their philosophy together really well. It is very, very hard to do in nutrition. It is very hard to talk about food and what makes things healthy without demonizing certain, you know, foods, like in this instance, sugar. And I think that they have done that really well. They really, it's not an all or nothing approach. It is hard to make, you know, swap, make easy swaps and make good decisions and help your children to make good decisions most of the time without being that anally retentive parent that is like hovering over them at parties being like, no, you can't have that piece of cake. It's got the sugar in it. You know, actually being able to be like, look, control what you can, and but also let them have those treats as well. It's not about what they do every now and again, but about what they do most of the time. So that is what we're going to be talking about today. Before we go into that, I just wanted to also explain a little bit about, so Emily co-authored this book with Dr. Michael Gorin. So Michael is the professor of pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. It's a really well-known university for a lot of the nutrition and medical research that comes out. His special interest started off as pediatric or children's obesity, so trying to work out why children were becoming, you know, more obese earlier than what they ever had before. And he's in the book, in the introduction of the book, he actually explains that you know, originally the research was looking at different biometric markers and stuff like that, and then he got some new research come across his desk which was all about the sugar content in different foods, especially foods that children love, like sugar sweetened beverages and juice and candy and cake and stuff like that. But it wasn't just about the amount of sugar, which was, you know, you'd think, oh, well, that's not necessarily groundbreaking, but it was that the type of sugar. And this was early in the days where we started to understand about how high fructose containing sugar differed so much in terms of how our body processed that than the non, like this, more the glucose containing sugar, which is more prevalent in our in food in years gone by, you know, like our grandma's generation that didn't have this high kind of fructose. And also what he was really interested in is just how much more was not labeled in labels. So things that, you know, weren't labeled, like pizza, you know, pizza that would come the bases laden with sugar, but also the sauce used on it also laden with sugar. I know just as we're recording this, there's been a big blow up in the media about, in Ireland, Subway has been told they can't label their bread because it's got more sugar than is what actually you're allowed to include in bread in Ireland. And for anyone that's in the nutrition field, we've known for many, many years that Subway bread specifically has had quite a lot of sugar in it. But it's not the only one, right? There's so many of the other fast food. I mean, I know a similar thing, I think, happened to McDonald's when it came to hamburger buns and stuff like that, but that it's sort of insidious in what it's included into, and how you know, might think that you're making a really healthy choice based on the marketing around that food. But, and I mean, Subway is a prime example of this. I mean, they have been marketing that healthy choice for years, but actually when you get down to it, you know, I'm sure that you'd be very surprised if you grabbed a teriyaki chicken sub, how much sugar is actually in that sauce of the teriyaki chicken, and then when the bread, possibly the mayonnaise that you use as well, and combined, what kind of dose you're getting there. And so Michael's work now is really focused on understanding the metabolic factors linking obesity to things like insulin resistance and growth and development, and especially in the early development of that in children as well. So this is why I wanted to talk to Emily, is because these guys are really well educated, they're very well researched and very credible. But I also like the fact that in the book they aren't preachy. They're very down to earth. They're very, you know, cognizant of making sure that children are set up with really good patterns without demonizing food and without developing disordered eating patterns. So let's get on and chat to Emily and hear all about what you can do as a parent to help your children. Emily, thank you so much for joining me here. It's so nice to have a chat to you. So I thought that would be a good place to start was actually, I know this is not really what we're going to be talking too much about today, but knowing that you also have PCOS, I really want to know about your journey and how you kind of, what the symptoms were for you when you got diagnosed, how it worked for you, how your fertility journey was, and really what some of those symptoms that you're starting to now really understand are all coming together around PCOS and, you know, your book around Sugar Proof.
Thank you so much for having me, Claire. It's really such an honor to be able to have this chance to reflect and also to talk about the book. So I first got my period when I was 12, and it was never regular. I didn't, of course, know what to expect, so I didn't really know how irregular it was and how different what I was going through was to other, you know, my other friends. But finally, when I was 17, I saw a doctor about it, and he put me on birth control. And he also gave me another medicine, spironolactone, because I was complaining about excess hair. And so those, you know, we didn't talk about PCOS at that point. I don't know if he realized I had it or what, but it certainly wasn't mentioned to me. So I just continued with those drugs for a number of years. You know, I went off to university and I just kept taking them, and it was kind of masking the symptoms that I was having. It regulated my period and it helped with the hair. But, you know, it wasn't helping me with some of the other symptoms like these frequent episodes of low blood sugar. I would have these blood sugar attacks. You know, when you're a freshman in university, college, it's probably not the time when everybody's thinking too much about healthy eating. I thought I was doing okay. I was actually a vegetarian and for a part of the time vegan. So I was, you know, I was eating fruits and vegetables and stuff like that, but I was also eating a lot of carbohydrates. During my vegetarian years, I was eating a ton of dairy products, and I just wasn't feeling well. I was feeling terrible, actually. And I just thought that I just was sort of prone to these blood sugar attacks and kind of gotten used to them. But in hindsight, you know, I was riding what we call in Sugar Proof the sugar roller coaster all the time. Just, you know, constantly having these crashes and having to compensate and carrying around snacks and things like that. And it wasn't until much later that I realized what was going on. I finished up university and got married and moved around some, and then ended up going to grad school at USC, which is where I met Michael, who's the co-author of the book, professor there. And I was working for him. And I started to learn more about, you know, glycemic index, and I started to realize, oh, wait a second, like this bowl of cereal with soy milk that I'm having in the morning is really not doing me well. And I slowly started to change, you know, what I was eating, and I started to see different effects, and I started to not have these blood sugar emergencies as much. I was about 25 at the time, and I was, you know, starting to kind of think about having kids. It was still, you know, still doing my PhD, so I wasn't really ready, but, I started to think about it. So I saw a specialist in Los Angeles who, ended up sending me for an ultrasound, and that's when I was formally diagnosed with PCOS. And he did different tests. I actually also participated in one of his research studies. And so I had a frequently sampled intravenous glucose tolerance test, as well as an oral glucose tolerance test. And that's where, and then he told me, yeah, you have a high insulin response.
And that's so good to know that relatively early in your journey. I know that seems late because you were, you know, now by now in your later 20s, when actually having known that at university would have been so helpful. But it's still good to get that, you know, not just the diagnosis, but pretty quickly learn that insulin was definitely a confounding trigger, kind of root cause for you.
Definitely. Yeah, I can't tell you how much I wish I would have been able to learn about some of this earlier, you know, to listen to your podcast and have some of this information in my 20s and early 30s would have been amazing. But it is what it is. You know, I ended up figuring it out. And that doctor told me that I was going to have a really hard time conceiving. And, you know, he prepared me for this whole, like, series of, you know, treatments that he thought I was going to need and all these things. But as it turned out, I actually didn't need any of those. I was able to get pregnant with my first son pretty much right away after deciding, you know, I was ready. And, you know, so that hasn't been a problem. And I do attribute that to the changes in my diet that I made through what I learned as a graduate student.
I think that's the case for so many of us, get told you're going to struggle to conceive. And actually, I think what we need is the context around that. So it's like, okay, you know, right, that doctor seeing you at that point in time might be saying, well, you're not ovulating. So yes, of course, it's going to be bloody hard to conceive if you're not producing an egg, right? Like one of the two critical factors, an egg and a sperm, and we're missing one of those. So yes, that's going to be very hard to conceive. Doesn't mean that you're never going to ovulate, or that you're not, you know, like your cycle isn't always going to be 60 days in terms of, you know, instead of 38 days. I'm just making up numbers here. I'm not saying that was you, but you know, that's what I wish they gave the context, is being like, okay, in this context, yes, that would be hard to conceive, but you can fix that. You know, if you bring your insulin down, yes, it's likely that you will start to ovulate again, and that will be, and also your egg quality is going to be a bit better. You're also going to be less predisposed to developing gestational diabetes and all of the other stuff that we should get told, instead of just being saying, hey, you're going to struggle to conceive, and hey, just come back to us, we'll give you some medication, which is a real half-truth.
Well, it's so true. And also just acknowledging that for all of us that have PCOS, we all have different, you know, manifestations of it. Okay. And so, yeah, so it's, you know, some people
have, yeah, you know, yeah, you're right. Like some people don't even have, like, don't, you know, wouldn't even have to do anything and they still conceive easily, mm-hmm. right? Like it's not even that they've really addressed the root cause, like I say. It's just actually that their presentation of PCOS is that fertility is not affected, and so therefore they're totally fine. But also it's really good to know that actually women with PCOS, well, people with PCOS have as many children as people without PCOS in their lifetime, right? Wow. Like that is,
that's really encouraging.
Yeah, so we know this from the research that they have just as many. It might be that the time taken to get to that, you know, first one, or might be a little bit longer for them. Instead of getting pregnant like you right away, it might take a year or it might take 18 months. But in the span of their lifetime, it is just as many as those without. So it's not it's not a case that I say it's not a condition of infertility. It's a condition of subfertility for some people. So. Yeah. So then how did you get into this area of research, and especially in the children and sugar consumption? Was this when you were working with Michael in your PhD studies?
It was, that's when I really, really got into it. But actually my interest in it started a little bit earlier. I've always loved to cook, and it's sort of my creative outlet. And just keep gravitating in that direction. I was an environmental studies major, biology and society with the Latin American studies concentration. But when I went, for example, to study abroad in Ecuador, I just couldn't help studying the food. That was what was most interesting to me, and family dietary habits. And I just kept gravitating toward that. And then I decided, well, if I like this so much, I'm, you know, I kind of would rather just be doing this as my profession too. And I had a great internship early on at the Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley, which is a garden, school garden and kitchen project that was started by Alice Waters, who's kind of known as like inspirational chef, and, you know, kind of brought the whole farmer's market scene to the States. And she's been such a champion for edible education for kids. So her project has kids come into the garden and help grow things and then harvest it and bring it to the kitchen. And those lessons are incorporated into the whole school curriculum. So it might be doing math in the kitchen with, you know, fractions and measuring, or history and learning about background of different cultures and their cuisines, things like that. So I worked there for a summer, and that really got me interested in it. And, you know, I had a few different jobs. I worked as a cook and worked doing public relations for a restaurant, and then decided I was ready to go to graduate school, and ended up working for Michael in his lab and doing some research for him with him on diabetes prevention and obesity prevention in children. And I was able to teach classes in the community there as well. And yeah, it was just, you know, really something that I enjoy. And so it turned out to be a really good fit for me.
Yeah. So in the book Sugarproof, Michael talks about that was that the time that he really got the research on his desk where he was like, wow, okay, we really need to be looking at sugar?
Yes. Yeah, so I was in his lab at that time when he decided to conduct the study where we bought different products and even went through like fast food drive-thrus and got different soft drinks with no ice and sent them away to laboratories to have them analyzed to better understand the exact sugar composition of those foods. Because the food label doesn't tell the full story.
Yeah.
Especially back then, food labels didn't even tell added sugar content. It was just total sugar.
Right.
And they certainly didn't break down the different types of sugar. So you wouldn't know, you know, is this drink sweetened with, you know, or what's the percent fructose, even though you know that it has high fructose corn syrup in it. So that was really eye-opening. And that I think for Michael was a big aha moment when he realized, wait a second, these products have so much more fructose than we imagined. And it started to really click with some of his other research findings, seeing the health effects in children, specifically with sugar-sweetened beverages.
Yeah. And so now we know a lot more about, we'll hear a lot more about high fructose corn syrup, but back then this was quite new information. But I think probably what I haven't spoken to you guys about, and no, this is what I'll ask you about, Emily, was really what is it about high fructose corn syrup that makes it so damaging for us, and then let's go into it for children. So what is it about that really is the more kind of damaging of the sugars?
So any sugar that's high in fructose is especially hard on the body. And, you know, high fructose corn syrup, I think, you know, we've known for a long time that it wasn't great for us, but we didn't know exactly how high of a percentage of fructose was in some of the products, you know, in some of the formulations of that syrup. But these findings aren't just limited to high fructose corn syrup. And in fact, what's really confusing and sneaky now about our food system is that there's a lot more sweeteners that are fructose-based now, like fruit juice concentrates, and even things like agave syrup that are really high in fructose that sound quite a bit healthier. So, you know, parents, you see the food label, oh, it's fruit juice sweetened, or, oh, this has agave in it, you know, but not realizing that is really, those are sugars that are high in fructose that the body processes largely in the liver and ends up turning that sugar into fat, and that fat can be deposited in the liver and can contribute to the silent development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But also that fat can be redistributed in other places in the body and contribute to other problems. And in a more immediate sense, excess fructose can contribute to issues in children or in adults like fructose malabsorption and lead to a lot of digestive issues and potentially leaky gut and inflammation. Problems, you know, that parents, you know, probably not aware of, you know, might think, oh, it's not so bad. My kid drinks juice. It's not soda, right? Yeah. But actually that can have, you know, the same type of load of sugar and fructose as a soft drink and can be, you know, causing silent damage that parents are unaware of.
Yeah. And I think that I think in our generation, especially, that irritable bowel syndrome really started to come to the forefront. And this is possibly a contributing factor, because we are the generation of the children of the 80s and 90s where everything was fat reduced and therefore everything was sugar. You know, they replaced what they took out of fat with sugar to make it palatable, because if you just remove fat and you don't replace it with anything, it's pretty unpalatable. And, you know, like I just see so many, and it especially seems to affect young women. Something to do with the estrogen potentially and how that mediates the gut, but they're so much more prone to irritable bowel syndrome symptoms, and it's quite debilitating. You know, it's very, very debilitating for many of those. And so, you know, we also do we see that kind of happening in even younger children now as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the examples of, you know, some of these health effects that we're seeing, that a lot of times the connection isn't made.
Yeah,
and then, you know, there's other factors that could be contributing as well. But certainly, you know, giving your children juice and things like that puts them at higher risk for having digestive troubles.
Yeah. What about, I know that also what you spend a lot of time in the book talking about is really the behavioral changes that can come from from a high sugar consumption, and specifically high, whether that's, you know, high fructose consumption or sugar in general. But how does that develop? So how does it manifest that sugar and what we just, you know, talked about there with leading to the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and really just thinking about it being wrapping your organs in fat, and that's not necessarily fat that the body can use for energy, right? Like it's the internal fat that is quite insidious and very hard for the body then to get rid of, break down. But what is it about that then leads to the sort of the behavioral changes that we often see?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that, you know, the past research done like in the late 90s about sugar and behavior, the conclusion was that there wasn't a link, that there wasn't, you know, we couldn't replicate those effects. Yeah. But looking back at those studies, a lot of them used low calorie sweeteners as controls. And now we know that it's not just sugar, but it's also some of the other alternatives that can also affect children's behavior. And you know, what's interesting about it is that you might not always see the same effects in the same child, you know, on two different days. There's other factors that can be involved. So, you know, if your child has a lot of sugar, but is also really tired, you might see, you know, one version of the effects as opposed to another. Or, you know, as we know with combining foods, like if your child has a lot of sugar on an empty stomach, the effect is probably going to be different than, you know, if they're having a small amount on a full stomach or the same amount on a full stomach, in terms of the overall, you know, glycemic load of that eating episode or whatever they're drinking. So, you know, we're starting to learn more that, you know, these things are nuanced, but there definitely is a connection between sugar and behavior. You know, I can tell you that from my review of the literature, but I can also tell you that as a mom, my kids are 5 and 8 now, and I see it. And I see it in myself too. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be able to write this book, was just because I've realized that I am not a good parent when I'm on the sugar roller coaster. And I know my kids are a lot harder to parent when they're on the sugar roller coaster. And it's just, it's nice to be able to share some simple solutions to help, you know, parents keep their kids at a more steady level of energy and moods.
Absolutely. Because we all know, like, well, I know that most of you guys listening will know what a hangry attack feels like, or that, you know, that low blood sugar episode. And you know yourself, like, you can't think straight, you can't rationalize things until you actually get that, you know, like your blood sugar more stable, you know, basically until you eat some food which gets your blood sugar a bit more stable. So we can kind of see how children would be like that, right? They can't be rational. I mean, children haven't really developed the ability to be as rational as, you know, because they're sort of still developing it. And so you imagine if you have that less ability to do that, and then also you have the like the sugar roller coaster, how it's just, they're incapable of having being rational, and so therefore that's why you're getting tantrums and everything else. But is it just the, like, sort of that on that sugar coaster, or is there something else inherent about the way that sugar affects brain behavior? Is there anything different there as well?
It's a really good question. I mean, we know that there are links, you know, from some of these large studies, and even smaller studies that show that sugar can affect your mood. And also, you know, like the gut brain axis, what, you know, the effects of sugar on your gut bacteria and how those impact your neurotransmitters, and, you know, how that ends up signaling to your brain and can lead to things like anxiety or depression, or also, you know, lapses in memory and concentration. So, and it's a complex equation, really. And you know, I think it's important to look at things as interconnected.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're so right. It's actually a little bit wrong of me to ask that question. But especially when we know as well that it's also nuanced with us individuals and how we respond to different foods. And you know, you guys listening to this know this, because this is what I always say, that we're not all the same, right? Like, your friend can eat porridge for breakfast and have, you know, like a, you know, we were talking about this before we joined the call, actually. Emily was listening to the podcast that I did with my colleague Sophia, where we ate the same thing for a week and we tested our blood sugar and just saw the different responses that my blood sugar had to versus her blood sugar. So, for example, porridge was one of the examples where she ate, we both ate porridge. It was sort of more the quick oats variety, we'll give you that. But my blood sugar just skyrocketed, like was just like straight up and straight back down within sort of an hour. And yeah, then I was kind of getting that shaky, jittery hangriness. Hers pretty much just flatlined. You know, there was no, like no real rise. And so this, you know, can be, you know, like genetics, it can be how you've developed, how your gut bacteria has developed over time. And so, you know, that's probably why it is also so hard when we do any randomized control trial with nutrition, is because we are different. And same thing, children are no different. So their response, as you said, both inter individual, so between the individuals in the study, but also on different days, depending on what they'd eaten, how they'd slept and things like that, is also going to mean that it's very hard to replicate. It's not like, And the reason being that randomized control trials were set up really well for drug studies, right? And that's what they do really well, is when you have one variable like a drug and there's a placebo that an individual wouldn't be able to tell the difference between, they can see what's working. They're not set up very well for testing behavioral changes, which is so, you know, influenced by so many factors.
That's true. And that was a really brilliant, I loved that episode of your podcast, by the way. For any of you listeners that haven't heard that one yet, that's definitely one to put high up on your list. It's really, really insightful. Yeah, and that you do really need to just, you know, try and learn what works for you. And I think, you know, we give a lot of different suggestions in the book, and families can kind of take what works best for them. And just building that awareness at a younger age that, you know, as we say, you know, you feel how you eat. And that can be slightly different for different people, you know. So some people can handle a little bit more sugar or different types of foods than others, or more fruit than others. You know, the earlier you learn about yourself and what works for you, the better you are.
Absolutely. And so one thing that I often really struggle with, though, is how to teach your child this in a way that's going to set them up for good eating patterns, but not for disordered eating. You know, given that I think this research is something like 20% of people with PCOS have had some disordered eating patterns. And that, I think is a real concern, making sure that we're like not demonizing foods, kind of like sugar and stuff like that, for children, and that there is, that they can still enjoy stuff and there's no sort of good and bad foods. How have you, as a mom and also as working with children, how would you recommend to start to develop that, those good eating patterns without the kind of the labels of good and bad and demonizing sugar?
I'm so happy you brought that up. And it is, it's been important to us from the start to make sure that we're not demonizing sugar. And, you know, as parents, both, you know, I don't restrict my children to that degree by any means, and neither does Michael with his daughters, and neither do we with the families, you know, that we work with. Yeah, I mean, we try and give the message that you can still enjoy these things in moderation, but really it's more about kind of thinking about, okay, like what are the daily staples that families are relying on, and, you know, how much sugar is in those, and, you know, how much sugar is everyone getting overall, and sweeteners, and then what's worth it to them. So I try and help my kids go through that process for themselves, and try and also make them aware of, like, okay, you know, if you were to eat a big piece of chocolate cake for breakfast, how would you feel? you know? And so I think, you know, especially for kids, they need the room to be able to try that out. So I don't always want to be the one saying, you're going to feel bad if you have that, mm-hmm. because I want to try it and see, you know, did they enjoy that? You know, was that ice cream the right size for them, or was it way too big and did they feel sick after, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I want to give them the chance to grow and learn and to not be patrolled on that. So we do that by just sort of, well, there's a lot of ways we do that. We have the theoretical background that we present in the book is based on motivational interviewing, which is a technique that research use a lot, and we've used in research studies. to help adults or children to find their own reasons why they might want to eat healthier. Mm-hmm. And some of the reasons that the kids are interested in are completely not what the parents were thinking. And, you know, you also give them the space, you know, that one of the principles is called roll with resistance. So give them the space to say, actually, this isn't really something I care about right now. And the moment might come later. But, you know, a lot of times you can go about these things without focusing in on taking something out of your diet. So you don't have to focus on taking out the sugar. You can just focus on adding in some of the healthier foods, you know, by saying, hey, let's go to the farmer's market and point out which, you know, vegetables look good. Should we try this? Or, you know, what do you want to try? Or, you know, would you like to help me pick out a recipe? Or, hey, want to help take some Brussels sprouts off the stalk? My five-year-old did that yesterday and he had a lot of fun with it.
So satisfying, isn't it? So popping, like when they like pop off.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's just like, it's an overall experience, I think, of being, growing up to be involved with your food and to, you know, to have the exposure to different tastes, not, you know, the simple tastes that come with, you know, some of these more processed foods.
Yeah. So, and that's, I think that's something that's quite hard, especially if you yourself haven't been exposed to that when you were young. Like I am in a very privileged position that I grew up on a farm. So I know where our entire food chain comes from when it's a non-processed food, right? So it's like, I know where eggs come from. I know where milk comes from. I know where meat comes from. I know the gore of actually having to get that onto your plate. I know which foods grow below the ground and which foods grow above the ground. This is something that I've always found quite fascinating when I'm talking to my clients, is I'm like, oh, well, just think about the foods that grow below the ground. And they're like, I would have no idea what grows below the ground. I'm like, oh, that's actually really fascinating. I hadn't recognized that that was something that was just inherent to my understanding, but is not necessarily inherent to everybody's understanding.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. And you know, everybody's going to be starting off on this kind of, you know, if you're starting into a new journey with healthy eating, everybody's probably starting in a different place, and that's okay. And so that, you know, there's the chance to start wherever you're starting on the journey, you know, either even before you have your children or together once you already have children. And that's okay. You know, if your range of vegetables and healthy foods that you like at the moment isn't too wide, that's all right. You know, just start where you are and, you know, try out some different things and it's okay. You know, I've been thinking a lot about how sometimes we expect that kids should like everything and, you know, you never know. Is it just because they're kids and they're just, you know, they haven't grown into this yet, or is it because, you know, they don't like asparagus now and they're never going to like it their entire life? You know, we never know. But one thing that we've learned, you know, through research and also as parents, is like, if you just keep exposing kids to different things, you know, one day they might decide they want to try it and they might decide that they like it. You know, my five-year-old, so my eight-year-old loves artichokes and he's loved artichokes for a really long time.
Amazing.
And yeah, but my five-year-old has been exposed to them ever since he was, you know, old enough to try them, and he's never wanted to touch it. Just not at all interested, totally put off by artichokes. And then a few weeks ago, we had them on my eight-year-old's birthday at his request, as his, you know, one of the dishes. And my five-year-old said, "Can I try one leaf?" And sure, of course you can. And it was totally his idea. I didn't even offer it to him. It was just on the table. And he tried it and he's like, "Can I have my own artichoke?" And then it was like, "Can you go back to the store? Can we have two of those tomorrow? And can I make them?" So I have no idea what prompted him to want to try it that day. But it was his idea. So
that's amazing. But I think we can probably all think as well of things that we didn't necessarily love when we were children. Like, I'm just thinking, my sister hated mushrooms, now loves mushrooms, right? Mm-hmm. I interestingly had a very, very bad gag reflex to anything mashed. So like mashed potato, mashed pumpkin, which when we were young, we had a pumpkin farm. Like, so it's actually squash, the green, you like the green kind of butternut squash.
Yeah.
My parents used to export that to Japan. And so we had all of the reject stock So it was pumpkin, it was squash any way possible. Roast squash, mash squash, squash pie, anything. It was like on Forrest Gump where it's like shrimp soup, shrimp gump, like, you know, like that was us but with squash. And so like it was the worst night ever when it was squash pie night because I just had this like horrible gag reflex and real texture. Mine's more texture rather than flavors. So it's like anything that texture, whereas now totally fine. Fine with that. Yeah, it kind of grew out of it at about, it didn't start until I was probably five or so, and then grew out of it by the time I was about 16. But it prevailed for quite a while.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, all of this is just acceptance and, you know, kind of being relaxed about it, I think, and also with your kids. So we really try and take the approach, not just with healthy foods, but also about sugar, is not coming down on kids with like this top down, you know, commanding type approach. It's more just sort of about raising kids to be more aware and to have a broader palate as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, the more that you can expose them to new flavors and you know, whole foods, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the exposing part. What about the stopping them getting on the sugar roller coaster from the start? Because this is something that I found so great from your book, because this is what I do with all of our women in the Peace Rest Protocol, is we first step, if their insulin is an issue, is that we swap out their breakfast and we get them off that sugar roller coaster from the start of the day. So how do you do that with children? Like, how do you set them up right from the start? Because I know you said, you know, your cereal and soy milk wasn't such a great option for your blood sugar. So what do you recommend for kids, given that's something that they're generally also going to eat?
Yeah, it's true. So breakfast, I completely agree with everything you just said, and we take that as our first focus as well. Because one episode of a, you know, spike in blood sugar and a crash just can fuel that same cycle for the entire day. And it's really hard to get off of once you're on it. So if you can start off the morning in a different way and not get on it in the first place, you're so much better. So, you know, for my own kids, I try and push them more in a savory direction for breakfast as much as possible. That's not always going to be possible for all families. And I think it depends kind of what your starting point is. You know, so if your kids are really used to breakfast cereal and that's what they like, and you're having a sweetened version, you know, then just a first step is to say, okay, well, let's try a different cereal, you know, one that has minimal added sugars. And then if they want a little extra sweetness, you can, you know, put some fruit on it. I personally cannot eat that type of breakfast, like cereal with fruit just does not work for me. Any type of iteration of that doesn't work for me. And interestingly, I've noticed that my kids don't do well with that either. You know, even if they have a plain bowl of low sugar cereal with milk or with yogurt, an hour later they're hungry, they're asking for another bowl of cereal or another snack, and then continually all morning. So for my family, that doesn't work great. But for a family that's, you know, used to eating Fruit Loops and toast with jam and a glass of juice, then actually making that swap to low sugar cereal is a really great first step. And, you know, and maybe their kids can do well with that in the long term too. So I think it's kind of figuring out what works for your family. What works for mine is going more savory entirely. So one of my kids likes, we make this like buckwheat chia bread, and he'll have toast with smoked salmon, or my kids like spinach and eggs, or they like even a corn tortilla with cheese and black beans in it.
Yeah.
Easy breakfast. Or sometimes they'll just have like whole grain toast with peanut butter. Mm-hmm. But then again, they're hungry. My kids are hungry again in like 40 minutes after that. So you kind of have to figure out, you know, what works best for your kids, and kind of do the detective work to see what's happening at 9 or 10 a.m. I think for a lot of us now with COVID, we're seeing our kids more in the mid-mornings, especially if they're doing distance learning. I mean, certainly you can observe your kids on the weekend too if they're at school during the week. But interestingly, a lot of parents are not seeing what their kids, you know, in a normal school situation, are not seeing what's happening at 9 or 10. And, you know, we tell a story in the book about a mom that got an email from her teenage daughter's science teacher saying, you know, Grace is falling asleep every morning at 9:30 in my class, you know, trying to figure out what's going on. And her parents thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, her 9:30 bedtime seemed reasonable. Maybe she needs to go to bed at 9, or, you know, maybe we need to take the phone away. So they tried those things and they didn't help. And then flash forward, they wound up participating with us during our 7-day no added sugar challenge, which is an activity that we propose as an option in the book, where families just go for a week taking out sugar just to see, you know, what happens and to kind of raise awareness. And sure enough, when she swapped her breakfast out, she was no longer falling asleep in class. And, you know, her previous breakfast was something like Honey Nut Cheerios, cereal with milk and a glass of orange peach mango juice. And then she was also having vitamins. So she was having a gummy multivitamin and a gummy calcium chew.
So each with probably like a teaspoon of, I think the gummies, some of the guys' gummies are like a teaspoon of sugar each.
Right. So, you know, it was just a real big load of sugar that was making her sleepy, you know, an hour or two later, I guess 2 hours later.
Yeah. And so for those that are working with you in terms of the, you know, the having what she's having, like the Honey Nut Cheerios and stuff like that, what would you start with? Would you go, right, okay, let's try and swap out the, you know, the fruit juice maybe first? Or would you kind of go all at once and go, right, let's go for a lower sugar cereal or lower, what have you found works best? Titrating them off or swapping them all out?
We leave it up to families, really. So, you know, we have this idea of these challenges, which are options. You don't have to do them, but if you want to do them, there's two options. There's a 7-day challenge where you go cold turkey and you would take out all of those things and replace them with other things. Or we have a 28-day challenge, which is about just gradually reducing. And for that one, we suggest coming up with a couple goals and either working on them simultaneously or working on one per week, depending on what seems more feasible. Sometimes parents are really overwhelmed. You know, it's like if you're used to just going downstairs quickly in the morning and, you know, either popping a toaster waffle in the toaster for your kids or letting them pour their own cereal, it's really kind of overwhelming to think about making a big overhaul.
Yeah.
So, So, I mean, there's so many different ways you can go about this and, you know, getting the kids involved or, you know, making some things the night before can be really helpful as well.
Yeah, but I think that's certainly getting some protein into children in the morning as well as us adults, right? This is what we focus on in the protocol a lot, is actually just overhauling that breakfast and actually increasing that protein to increase satiety, because I'm sure that no parent wants to be continuously bombarded with the, I'm hungry, like what snacks we got, because snacks I think are probably one of the hardest things. How do you prepare sort of like those small things that are going to be healthy without them being, you know, like more grab and go, which tend to be more processed, therefore tend to have a lot of added sugars and stuff in it as well. So the meals, you know, from my perspective anyway, are so much easier, not being a parent, but just in myself, you know, there's so much easier to, you know, to do that. So if we can, not that I'm saying that kids shouldn't snack, but if we can get them, you know, 2 or even 3 hours between snacks, as opposed to what you were saying your boys were, which was an hour after eating that cereal, they were like, I'm hungry again.
What actually you brought that up, because I should have, you know, mentioned that from the start. Yes, it's about protein in the morning and also fiber.
Yes.
You know, real nutritionally speaking, things that we talk about are important to lower the glycemic index of breakfast. And healthy fat, you know, adding in some healthy fat can go a long way as well, you know, whether it's in the form of some avocado or nuts. You know, my family likes smoked salmon. Not everybody likes that. One of my boys even likes salmon out of a can, or sometimes I'll eat leftovers. I'll just eat, you know, whatever we had at dinner, I'll have again at breakfast.
Totally. I'm all for the
different ways. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to include protein and fiber at breakfast. So it's just about playing around with what is most appealing to you, what works best in your schedule.
And even like if it is something that, you know, you're going from sort of a sweet breakfast, then a smoothie I think can be one of the easiest things, with a bit of added protein powder and stuff in there as well. Because it's sort of that same, you know, you don't, it's not this sudden shock of having to go to eating something savory, which a lot of people find really off-putting, especially when they're you know, not necessarily feeling super hungry in the morning. And so, yeah. But I thought it was really fascinating in the book you outline actually how much protein children need by age.
Right.
And I'm going to read this out because I thought it was really fascinating. So between age 2 to 3 years, children need 13 grams of protein. So that's each day, right?
Right.
That's right, each day. Okay. Age 4 to 8 years, 19 grams of protein. 9 to 13 years, 34 grams of protein. And 4 to 18 years, 52 grams of protein. Is that the RDA for protein? Like in terms of that they're, that's just going to stop them having like protein deficiency, or is that kind of optimal levels?
I think more optimal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I think also just realizing that, you know, things vary a little bit per day, but it's just kind of general target. And the reason why we put that in there is just because, you know, if you're eating three meals a day, you know, kind of need to divide that out between the different meals, you know, just so that each meal has that the quality of protein in it to leave kids feeling good and to keep the glycemic index the right level. And so, you know, thinking about, okay, what protein foods can I add into breakfast? And then thinking about how much protein are in those foods and then kind of comparing that to the overall target for the day can be helpful.
Mm.
Not to say, you know, you have to like be counting the grams of these all the time, but it's just kind of give like a general indication.
Yeah, it is. But I think that's the thing. It's just the awareness. Like when you think, oh yeah, my, you know, like I give my 2-year-old a scrambled egg. It's like, yeah, well, cool. That's 7 grams of protein. How much of that are they actually getting in their mouth versus like on the tray or on the floor? And just, I think it's that being aware that, I mean, that's a really good start, but it's, you know, if you're, as you know, the girl who was falling asleep at science, like, it, you know, in her breakfast of the like the honey coated Cheerios and the like juice and, you know, probably protein level in that is negligible. Like, I don't even know if we'd get to 1 gram within the, within that. And so no wonder she's having, you know, so much sugar, it's like spiking up that sugar, and then also probably very little fiber in those processed Cheerios as well. So it's nothing keeping that blood sugar stable for more than sort of an hour or so.
Right. And then, you know, especially with things like juice where the fruit, yes, the fiber has been removed from that product. So yeah, there's nothing to slow down the absorption. Yeah. And it's a pretty common breakfast, honestly.
Totally. And that's the thing is that's, and for all really good intention, and I think that's the good thing about these podcasts is we can talk about this in a way that it's not like, hey, you've been doing a bad job. It's just like the awareness thing. It's just like, hey, this is actually what this is doing. And here's a way that you can start to make a few changes without having it be super onerous. Like you have to be getting up and cooking, you know, a full meal for breakfast. It's just like, hey, well, what about using some leftovers? What about having some tortillas in the fridge and you have some like a black bean, you know, sort of dish that you make up at the start of the week, and then that's in the fridge, like literally in like a glass container, and the kids grab it out, put some beans on, chuck some grated cheese on, put it in the like maybe the press to warm it up a little bit, and that's it. You know, like it's just as easy as putting some toast in the toaster and putting some jam on it. So
just a little shift in habits, you know. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of this stuff is really easy. My 8-year-old is into the chia pudding right now.
Oh, yeah, nice.
And the recipe is to make it in individual, like the recipe is calculated by individual portions. So you can just, you know, measure out a couple of tablespoons of the chia seeds and 3/4 cup of milk of choice and put that in the refrigerator. He loves that. He's good with that. Doesn't work for me, really. Mm. Chia pudding is not a great breakfast for me, but it's works for my kids. So
yeah,
just trying to figure out, you know, what is what's everybody like, what's easiest for everybody, and what's everybody like.
Yeah. How then do you deal with when it's not necessarily in your control? So that, you know, children aren't at home all the time, they're at school, maybe they get fed at, you know, lunch or breakfast at school, maybe they've going to parties, maybe they're at another parent's house, like where, you know, you might be doing, you know, you might be separated and your like partner's doing that and they're not necessarily on the same bandwagon as you.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the way I think about it as a mom is I just think, is this a one-off thing or is this a repeat thing that actually I should probably try and come up with, you know, a solution for? The great thing about this sugar-proof philosophy is that as your kids grow up this way, they can sort of start to be their own advocates. So for example, my kids are really used to choosing water if they're offered juice or water at a particular event. Even if I'm not there, they do that now, especially if they know, okay, it's, you know, cake is being served, so I should probably not have the juice. But really they just don't pick the juice because we don't drink it, right? But yeah, I mean, there's, you know, sometimes I think it's worth talking to whoever is helping you with your kids. Like if it's a grandparent, if it's your parents, you know, that could be a conversation worth having. If it's like, you know, grandparents are having kids multiple times a week or even once a week after school. And I think there's a way to do that more positively. So sometimes saying, hey, you know, these are some snacks and drinks and stuff that the kids really like that are also healthy. Could I bring them over to your house and we can have them? Or maybe instead of picking the graham crackers. Do you guys have graham crackers in New Zealand?
No, we don't. But we're so exposed to American culture that I know exactly what they are. Right?
Okay. Like, yeah. So I lived in the UK. Yeah, exactly. So those are a popular kid snack here in the States.
Yeah.
And, you know, so one of the families that we worked with said that her parents would always buy graham crackers and give those to her kids as, you know, seemingly decent option. But once she realized how much sugar, you know, was in them, she just suggested a different cracker that was more savory. And then she also suggested some other snacks entirely. And once her parents knew what to buy, then they were on board. It's more of just like sometimes when people feel criticized, but they don't really know an alternative, that sort of turns into a situation that's not as nice.
Yeah. What about then? So they're the kind of like more ongoing things. What about like a birthday party? You know, like, you know, as you said that your kids are now used to choosing, say, the water and things, but how do they get to that point? Like, what language are you using with them to go, right, how, you know, is it the, like you're saying, the motivational interviewing there rather than saying, oh, this is bad, this is good, it's more, how does that make you feel?
Right. I mean, so we're not always going to be able to control these things, and I think that's fine. You know, I think as parents, we're all going to go through situations where kids go to a party and have way more than we would like them to have, and kids don't feel good and, you know, afterward, and just sort of have to deal with that. But I think, yeah, I mean, the more you can kind of help your kids to navigate some of those situations when they're young, the better. So, you know, if I'm at a party with the kids, I'll kind of say, okay, here's this buffet table. Let's go up there together. And, you know, there's cookies, cakes, and brownies. Like, you know, which do you most want to have? And then maybe then, you know, on another occasion, I'd be happy to give you a brownie if you chose cake this time, you know. The letting kids know that nothing is going to be ultimately forbidden,
yes,
so that they don't feel like, you know, they have to approach the buffet and just like, this is my only chance to have all these. or, you know, also another thing that's worked really well for me with my kids is to just say, okay, we can have that in a bit, but let's check out what foods there are that are not sweet, so you can have those first. So this has worked really well also at the situation of like a hotel breakfast buffet on vacation where, you know, they walk in and there's like Cocoa Krispies and that's calling to them. And I'll say, well, that's breakfast dessert. So let's look at the other breakfast options. You know, do you want to have some eggs or, you know, like what are some other things you could have? And then we'll have a little bit of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I kind of help my kids walk through things, but I let them ultimately give them some agency to choose, you know? Yeah.
And I just think that that would be such a good skill to have had myself. You know, this is the sort of the, what you're talking about, I was like, yeah, I wish I'd learned that when I was young, rather than just being like, because that is what often a lot of us have think, especially if we've been restricting kind of sugar and other kind of sweet stuff in our life, is we're like, oh my God, well, this is my one chance. I'm going to eat everything possible on this buffet table, right? Like, and to have that behavior instilled from a young age of being like, cool, yeah, well, I can have that. Nothing, you know, I could have that anytime I wanted to. I could go down to the, I've got my own money. I've got agency. I can go to the cafe and buy myself a brownie anytime I want, really. Like, this is not my one and only opportunity.
Right. And also not making them feel shame, you know? So even my kids have the sugar-proof mom, you know, but I want them to know that that doesn't mean that they, you know, can't have some normal stuff, and I'm not going to, you know, be too strict about it. And I think, you know, you don't want kids to feel bad and guilty over what they ate, and it's completely not about that. So we're careful to kind of, you know, frame it in a healthy way.
Yeah, that's so good. And I think that it's just such a hard one to navigate, you know, especially for so many people with PCOS who may have some insulin issues, knowing now that they were sort of genetically predisposed to that and that their children are likely also going to be predisposed to this as well. So, and that they may have grown up where, you know, especially maybe if weight gain was an issue from when they were young as well, and from being, you know, always very like maybe shamed about that or shamed about what they were eating, not, you know, not just by other kids, but also maybe by adults in their life as well, is going, right, well, how do I help my children navigate this time that I know that they'll probably go through, but also in a way that doesn't set them up like it did for me. And I just think that that's such a fear of so many people that I work with. And I think your method is so brilliant that it's like, it's not about labeling food as good or bad. It's about, you know, using that motivational interview and getting them interested in healthy eating, healthy cooking, healthy growing if possible as well. And so in knowing where the food comes from, or at least choosing if growing is not an option, at least kind of choosing the food and seeing at farmer's market or even just at the supermarket, you know, trying different things. And then also going through into the, you know, setting them up for success at the start of the day by keeping that blood sugar low, I think is just such a great inclusive and holistic way of looking at this, rather than just saying, no, you can't eat sugar. It's like, well, okay, that kids are already on a sugar roller coaster. So that's what they're going to be craving, just like you do, right? So how do we actually, instead of just like, you know, it's you know, I wouldn't say to women or people that I work with, I wouldn't say, hey, you need to quit sugar. It's like, okay, no, we need to change your breakfast first to stop you getting on that sugar coaster from the start of the day. And then we can talk about reducing sugar later, but only after we've kind of like removed that issue at the start, which is what's really causing you to always be craving that. Because right. The same thing for kids, right? Like that's when they're on that, of course they're going to be reaching in their lunchbox for the sugary thing, or they're going to be going to the, you know, the canteen or the like school lunch and be grabbing the you know, the sugary juice or the chocolate milk or whatever first.
No, it's true. It's instinctual, you know, when you're having that kind of physiological response, even if you're not aware of it, you know. Yeah. And, you know, just, you know, making some changes in general to the home food environment can go a long way. And those are things that you can do, you know, when the kids are young and they don't really have as much input. When they're, you know, younger, you can just kind of raise them with having healthier stuff around. And some parents, even with older children, just kind of gradually start working things into the shopping, and you know, new things kind of start becoming more normal in the house too. So
yeah, and I think that what you said, just going through a bit of a pantry audit and looking at, well, what stuff are we giving that I might have thought was a pretty healthy choice, like, you know, a muesli bar or a fruit sweetened yogurt, or what are some of those things that actually are quite high in sugar that could be inadvertently making my child get on that sugar roller coaster, or even me myself, you know, like, and knowing that for yourself and going, right, how can we swap that out with, what could we swap that muesli bar for a small packet of nuts? Could we swap the like sweetened yogurt for a Greek yogurt? Could we swap the, you know, what are the other things that are quite hidden and insidious?
Yeah. Peanut butter, pasta sauce, stuff like that. Yeah. And then also just to address, I think we touched on it just slightly, but a lot of these products also have low calorie sweeteners in them. So sometimes
those
are showing up alongside of the regular sugars, or they're sweetened entirely with low calorie sweeteners. And a lot of parents are really confused about that, both for themselves and for their kids. So we suggest trying to take those out as well, just because the research is really limited. We don't really know about the long-term effects, but we do know that some of those things can elicit an insulin response. So mm-hmm. they can kind of cause that same sort of roller coaster effect.
Yeah.
Rise in insulin and then increased hunger.
Mm-hmm. Especially the artificial sweeteners, right? Like your sucralose, aspartame, those ones there. And the way that I've seen it, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but the way that I see it in the research is that the way they think this is doing it is because it's affecting the gut bacteria. And they haven't been able to prove it in human studies yet, but in animal studies they have. And so how is there any other mechanism that you're seeing that it could raise insulin?
Well, from what I understand, it's that actually the body thinks that it's had sugar because of it activates the sweet taste receptors. Mm-hmm. So that can cause your body to release insulin in the same way that it might if it had actual sugar. So there's definitely a brain connection there. And then also just the effect of ramping up sweet taste preferences, yeah. because some of these products are like 20,000 times sweeter than regular sugar. So, even if you're not getting the sugar, you're sort of reinforcing your desire and your tastes for that. Yeah. Those can be tricky.
Absolutely. And this is why I think that if you can move to more of a savory breakfast, it can be so helpful because you're then not starting the day triggering those sweet taste buds to then kind of want more. I think that, changing the breakfast, it doesn't have to be savory, but but that it can be an additional help if you're still finding that you are really still, craving sugar quite a lot, is that often it's a more of an, taste bud driven response rather than a sugar roller coaster response. Yeah. You seeing this just in the artificial sweeteners, or are you also seeing it in things like stevia and monk fruit and stuff as well? Do they have that same insulin response in your experience?
I don't think we fully know, honestly. Mm-hmm. So that's why, especially for kids, we feel like we're not comfortable recommending them. Because long-term, we just don't have enough information.
Yeah. I think, from what I've seen, we don't see anything at the moment, but it's not saying that we never will. But especially especially wary of the artificial sweeteners for the gut bacteria stuff. I think that's enough at the moment for me personally to go, I'm not comfortable with that for my health. And right. You can make the choice yourself, but personally, I wouldn't, I'm not comfortable with, given what we know about how important our gut bacteria is. As you mentioned before about the gut brain axis, and then how that can, that's basically what we mean by that is that your gut and your brain are intricately connected, and this is why we think that things like intestinal permeability, or otherwise known as leaky gut, inflammation, and can have a driving effect in so many neurological issues, both, from things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's right through to depression and anxiety as well. And behavioral issues like we discussed with children as well. Yeah. So, and it doesn't necessarily need to be like the clinical behavioral stuff like ADHD. It can just be, hypertension, deficit disorder. It can just be that, them not having the ability to concentrate or not having the ability to kind of regulate their own emotions. And right. responses to situations which they wouldn't otherwise right. respond in that same way.
True. Yeah, and there's been some interesting studies just looking at momentary, analysis of, having kids wear devices and pinging them and asking them how they're feeling at a certain moment and how stressed they are, how anxious they are, how depressed they are, and then linking that to the information on what they've been eating.
Interesting
study that was conducted at USC that we discuss in the book that showed connections between sugar and momentary assessment of mood. So, yeah.
Wow, fascinating. And so what was it? Was it that was there any kind of particular foods that linked to any particular mood?
Just higher sugar in general linked to right. more of those, those feelings and outcomes. So
interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of the research, when you break it down, shows an extra effect of liquid sugar. So, mm. it's another reason, I think, to focus on beverages.
Yeah, absolutely. So the liquid sugar being that it crosses the from your stomach into your bloodstream much quicker than any even whole food kind of, well, I mean, not whole food, but even just food-based forms of sugar.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just such a big dose all at once. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Right. So it's both not only just the form of it being that it's easy to, because your stomach and your, you know, hydrochloric acid isn't having to break that down. It doesn't need any breaking down. It's literally into the stomach, straight across into the bloodstream, but it's also the dose of it, you know, that you're getting, you know, that much more.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of them do happen to be higher in fructose, you know, especially if it's juice or soft drinks that are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. So that's another factor to consider as well. And some of the ones that are sweetened with artificial sweeteners also have been linked to weight gain, to depression, even to cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease, because some of the breakdown products of the sweeteners can cross the blood-brain barrier and have effects in the brain.
Yeah, incredible. And this, the juice is something that's quite good to bring up. I actually brought this up during COVID because I saw a lot of people that were like, oh my God, I need immune boosting stuff. So they were like reaching for juices or, you know, or juicing themselves, you know, getting things. And I just wanted to show that that is, you know, that's as, you know, as insulin spiking, whether you make it yourself at home with, you know, oranges and apples and, you know, fruits and stuff like that, or whether you buy it, it is still, you know, a huge, huge dose of fructose that your body is not really a natural amount. And when you remove out all of the fiber that's associated with that as a whole fruit, you likely, you know, you could easily get 6 oranges in a cup of orange juice. Yeah. You would very rarely sit down and eat 6 oranges, I think, in terms of like the stomach capacity and your fiber, your stomach would tell you you're full after 1 or 2. Whereas you just don't get that response because of, with a fruit juice.
Right.
So it's probably good to recognize that it's not just, you know, purchased juices. It can also be those that you're making them, yourselves. Vegetables, you know, probably a little bit better, but you're still removing all of that good fiber. I just wouldn't say that it's really a healthy thing. It's more of a treat food.
Yeah, we agree for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if they're homemade.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. It's just you're still doing the same thing in terms of stripping that out. No matter whether it's like cold pressed or whatever the brand is, it is still, that's what you're doing. You're stripping the fiber out. You're just getting that, you know, the fructose in the juice, and the amount that you're having is so much more. So good reminders. Anything else that I've forgotten to ask you, Emily? Anything else that you want to mention?
You've covered so much. I really thank you for taking a look at the book. And as I said, I've just really enjoyed your podcast. It's so informative. And there's still episodes that I want to listen to. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I know how many people you've helped. So.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. And same thing, you know, with the book, I really enjoyed reading the book. It was great. You know, as even as a non-parent, I found it super fascinating. And just some of the things you mentioned in there were just, I was like, oh my gosh, that's brilliant. I could easily use that with people that I work with and on myself. Like I said, you know, with the tricks around the buffet table and stuff like that, it was stuff I was like, oh well, yeah, I really wish I'd learned those habits at a much younger age. And of course, I really love the fact that it's really all about not demonizing the sugar and not setting children up for, you know, disordered eating patterns, but instead helping them with just knowing what makes them feel good, knowing what sets them up well for the day, and then how food can affect how they feel and how they behave and ultimately their health and long term. So I think it's a really great way that you and Michael have actually put that together, because it's very hard to do. Really, really, I think this is something that people don't understand in the nutrition industry, is like, it is very hard to clearly put messages across that don't demonize stuff that's not either good or bad. And you get torn to shreds by everybody, right? Like, there is someone who's going to be out there who is saying that you are, I don't know, either you're saying things that are not correct, or the research is not right, or the way that you've interpreted that research, or the way that you're expressing that. So I think that the way that you guys have done it, where you've taken the research, it's really easy to read book or listen to. I think that's a really great that you guys are doing an audible version as well, because I know that so many busy mums won't have the time to necessarily sit down and read it, and so listening to it can be a good one. But in a way that it is like, using that message but in a very positive way, and it is very, very hard to achieve. So well done.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. So the book, where can you buy the book from at the moment? Because I know the audible version isn't available yet, but where is the physical book and the Kindle version available from?
So anywhere you usually find books, you know, whether it's Amazon or indie bookshop online, it's, you know, it's available through all those type of resources. And then also we are on Instagram and Facebook at Sugarproof Kids, and we have a website, sugarproofkids.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, and we have a blog there as well.
Oh, that's great. That's really good. So just, are you on Book Depository? Because in New Zealand, we don't have an Amazon, so it's a bit hard. So yeah, right. So Book Depository for any Kiwis, anyone else. So I know that you've got a UK version, so UK Amazon or otherwise. Ebook version, I assume, sort of like Kindle and anywhere else that you would normally get your ebooks through. And then you're also doing other language versions at the moment.
Yeah. There's other languages in the works: Spanish, Russian, Estonian, Japanese, Vietnamese. There's a number of them in the works.
Amazing. That is so cool. Very, very exciting. So well done. As a fellow book writer, I know the pain. And all I can say is amazing. Well done. You've got there.
Well, looking forward to seeing your book as well.
Yes, so am I. Still yet to see a full version in print. I've only seen the PDF copies, so it'll be so good to actually have this in my hands when we actually release this podcast later. The book will have been launched, but having spoken about this now, well before the launch date, still yet to see a physical copy in my hand. I can't wait to hold it. So, so well done on everything. And thanks so much for getting this book out into the world. I think it is going to change so many families' lives. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Claire. It's been really fun to chat with you.
So I hope that you enjoyed that chat. As I said, I really like this book. I found it, even though I'm not a parent, I found it really easy to read. And I really like the fact that it's very well researched. These, Emily and Michael, are very credible, as you've heard Emily talk about, knows what she's talking about. And they have taken a really tough topic, which is, all about how to teach kids good habits, which can, as I said, you can get absolutely slaughtered for, because you're either, too saying the wrong things, or you're at risk of setting them up for kind of poor eating behaviors if you demonize food. But I think that they've taken a really, really good approach to it, which is, hey, we are parents ourselves. We know what this is like. We know it's hard. And we also know that it is really, it's a really tough subject to navigate without giving food kind of labels. And so I think that the way that they've done it is really, really brilliant. So all in all, I think a really great resource for any parent and anybody that is asking me how to help their children learn the behaviors that they wish that they had learned when they were a child. This would be the book that I would send them to. So that's all for today. I will be back next week. I think it's our last week before we break for Christmas, actually. Yeah, it is. I just checked up on that. So it is. So next week will be our last week, and we'll be doing a book club reader Q&A. So if this is the first podcast you listen to, then you maybe not have caught up on the fact that I just released my own book a couple of weeks ago. Well, actually, it was about a month ago now, but it's called Getting Pregnant with Full Peace. I can't even say it properly. God, I've been talking too long today. Getting Pregnant with PCOS. And as the title would suggest, it is really relevant for those that are either on their fertility journey or they want to understand how PCOS can affect fertility. Maybe you have been told you have PCOS and you'll struggle to conceive. In the book, you will learn that that's not necessarily true. You will learn about what makes up fertility, what makes good fertility, what can affect fertility, how PCOS affects fertility, and then what you can actually do about it. So, but also too, it's not about natural fertility, right? We're not here to say you have to get pregnant naturally. There are some brilliant medical treatments out there. It's really just about understanding what one might work for you, how they actually work, and what some of the risks are with those risks and complications so that you can make an informed choice for you about what you want to use. So that is that. You can find that in the show notes, the link to where that is sold, and get a copy of that if you so desire. And we'll also, of course, put all the links for Sugarproof, where you can buy that as well, and the website and also the social media where you can find out more information about them there too. So thanks so much, and we'll chat to you next week for our reader Q&A. Watch out on our Instagram stories this week for our question box. We'll kind of do that over the week as well. So if you've got a question about what you've read in the book, so this will be exclusively a book club reader Q&A. So if you've got questions from the book, then we'll be picking those to answer in that Q&A. So thanks so much, and we'll chat to you next week. Bye. Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.